I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, the bonds between girls can grow into strong ties among women. So how come those relationships get twisted? And how can parents keep positive relationships on track? The moms talk with the author of The Twisted Sisterhood in just a few minutes. But first, a few more minutes on the State of the Union and the economy. Much of the talk around the president's address has been devoted to the economy. And of course, the struggling economy is closely tied to the housing market and the ongoing problem of all those home foreclosures. It's estimated that nearly 2 million homes will be foreclosed upon this year. The company Realty Track says millions more are at least 2 months behind on their mortgage. This week, the foreclosure crisis is the focus of hearings by a House Oversight Committee. NPR's Chris Arnold has been closely tracking the foreclosure crisis since before it was even labeled a crisis, and he's with us now from Boston. Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Michelle.
Now, we're hearing that the numbers, as bad as they are likely to get even worse. How's that possible?
I mean, that's the thing with this foreclosure mess. Part of what's going on right now is that foreclosures had slowed down over the past few months because the courts were kind of rearing their head a little bit and saying, wait a minute, what have these banks been doing? This has to do with this whole robo-signing mess that you probably remember, where it came out that bank employees who were supposed to be going through all the documents for every home, I mean, you're taking somebody's house, it's serious. It turns out they weren't looking at any of the details, at any of the documents. They were signing tens of thousands of these foreclosure affidavits, and it was basically a fraud on the court, if you listen to the lawyers who were upset about it. So the companies sort of put everything on hold for a while. So that's definitely slowed things down. But as that's been happening, the backlog of foreclosures just keeps building up and building up. And this problem just keeps getting bigger and bigger.
We keep hearing about various things that the White House and Congress have tried to intervene in the problem, or at least to kind of staunch the bleeding. Has any of those things worked?
A lot of them have not worked at all. I mean, you know, this one Help for Homeowners program, I think, that Barney Frank put out, and it you know, $1 billion or something associated with it, and it helped one person, you know, after 8 months or something. The most promising one by far is the one that President Obama got behind, this Making Home Affordable plan. That's helped 500,000 people, so that's good. But it was hoped that the plan was going to help 3 to 4 million people. I mean, that's more the scale of this problem, and it's not really coming anywhere near that. So there's still a lot of disappointment even about that plan.
And why have none of these interventions been successful, at least certainly not to the degree that was hoped or hyped?
The banking system's wild and crazy and complicated, so there's a lot of reasons. But a central one has got to be that the banks have just not implemented this well. And I'm talking about the major banks out there, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, Chase, and the other big ones. They've got to do the legwork. They've got to say, okay, here's borrower X. How much do they make? Let's get them into this program. And there's just been no end of problems there. And to be fair to the banks, yes, there's 2 million people all at once going delinquent on their loans. That's a big problem. They weren't geared to deal with it. But they've had 3 years now to figure out how to deal with it. And all the time, you know, I talk to homeowners who, I faxed in my stuff 3 times. I look like I should qualify. As a reporter, I agree. It looks like they should qualify. And they go around and around faxing things. The bank loses them. Eventually, they lose their house. And, you know, I've seen this happen over something that's like a tax document that they sent in 3 times and the bank says they didn't get. So things are still very broken. And that's got to be a big part of why.
Well, the question, though, has to be, if these are administrative failures, why is there no penalty for that?
Well, that's exactly the question that some oversight officials in Washington have been asking. And that's, you know, might come up at this hearing later this week. The oversight inspector general for TARP, or one of them, has been saying exactly that, saying, look, you know, the government came up with this pretty impressive program. The banks are not implementing it well. And now the Treasury Department and the administration hasn't done anything to penalize the banks for that, or to kind of hold their feet to the fire. And that's where some of the conversation is focusing now. What can be done to sort of push this and make it work better?
So, Kristen, of course, as we know, there's a new Congress. The House Oversight Committee Chair Daryl Issa has called a hearing for tomorrow to open an investigation into this. He says that he'll be talking about the Troubled Asset Relief Program and the foreclosure crisis. So what do you think we can expect here?
Well, I think they will look at this issue of oversight. You know, why hasn't this program worked the way it's supposed to work? That's a big question. And I think what's really significant here is that, look, this is the first hearing that this oversight committee is having after the State of the Union. You've got this new divided Congress. The Republicans are in control of this committee. The first big issue they're bringing up is the foreclosure crisis and TARP. So that might signal a change. The foreclosure crisis has kind of taken a back seat to some of the other problems. Maybe we're going to see some more focus on this.
NPR's Chris Arnold joined us from his office in Boston. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Michelle.
Coming soon to a grocery store near you, some new labeling on processed food packages. Food manufacturers and grocery stores have teamed up to put nutrition information on the front of packages so consumers can make healthier choices. But as NPR's April Fulton reports, some experts say the new labels might be more confusing than helpful.
Food manufacturers have voluntarily decided to put little white boxes on the front of the food package. One will show calories, one will show saturated fat, one will show salt, and one will show sugars. These are things that are bad for you. These things contribute to health problems. And these are the boxes that health experts and the federal government want manufacturers to put on food. But food makers have their own ideas. They decided to add two more boxes to the other four. Those new boxes will show things that are good for you, like fiber or potassium. Kelly Brownell runs the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale. He says people won't know what to make of all these boxes.
Research has shown that the typical person lingers over a particular food item for only about 3 seconds. So to expect them to make use of a lot of symbols, I think, is wishful thinking.
In fact, Brownell and others think that labels should be simpler. No numbers, just three colors, red, yellow, and green, to show consumers what to watch out for. Scott Faber of the Grocery Manufacturers Association helped develop the food labels. He says consumers want nutrition information, but they want both the good and the bad. And they want specific numbers in the boxes because they don't want to be told what to eat.
It's not our place or government's place to tell them how a particular food fits into their diets.
The Food and Drug Administration has been working with the industry on new labels, but those talks broke down over what information to include and what to leave out. Later this year, the Institute of Medicine will come out with its own version of what the label should look like. Meanwhile, the food industry is planning a $50 million campaign to promote their new food labels. April Fulton, NPR News, Washington.
U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood is in Detroit today. He's there to speak with Ford CEO Alan Mulally about distracted driving. LaHood's self-described rampage against distracted driving has mostly focused on cell phone use in cars. But the secretary has also angered many people in the car business for criticizing infotainment systems like OnStar and Sync. As Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton reports, LaHood isn't the only one concerned about so many new high-tech distractions.
Let's get one thing straight right away. We're quite capable of safely driving our cars while listening to the radio, so don't worry about that. But studies show that using a cell phone in the car is distracting, and so are a lot of other things, especially if they pile up. Let's say you're driving and there's a kid in the back seat crying. That's distracting. If you remember the Ed Sullivan Show, you can think of that as one plate spinning on top of a pole. Let's say you're also late. That's another spinning plate. You're checking a map on your GPS for directions and traffic is getting heavy. Plate, plate. And if you get too many things going at once, those plates will start to fall.
If your eyes are off the road and your hands are off the wheel, that's a problem. And if your brain is engaged somewhere else, it makes it even worse.
Paul Green is with the University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute. Green and other safety experts have a new worry these days, known generically as infotainment systems. Ford, for example, has a new technology that replaces manual control knobs with a computer screen, with icons that you touch with your fingertips. It can take a lot of glances away from the road and a lot of your hand leaving the steering wheel just to switch on the air conditioning. David Champion of Consumer Reports says this system and others like it are too distracting.
Actually, Ford now, I believe, are having a tutorial that they put drivers through before they buy the car, which is ridiculous, really.
Champion says voice commands have the potential to be less distracting, but if they don't work, it can be just one more spinning plate. Ford officials declined to be interviewed about the so-called My Ford Touch system, saying driver distraction is an industry-wide problem. So we ask Dave Sullivan of Auto Pacific to demonstrate in a Lincoln MKX by verbally requesting a specific song.
Playing Song Carve Your Name.
So it heard you wrong.
It did not recognize the words Backdoor Man, which is a Sarah McLachlan song. Instead, it's playing Carve Your Name by the Nadas, a small Iowa band.
So, add infotainment systems to the growing list of distracting technology we use in our cars. But while we know that distracted driving kills people, about 5,000 last year, it doesn't seem to be getting any worse. There were about a 500,000 accidents in 2010 due to distracted driving. It's a big number, a big problem, but not a growing problem. Adrian Lund is president of the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety.
People were distracted before, and they're still distracted. They're just distracted by different things, and they're crashing for slightly different reasons. More of them are cell phones rather than changing a CD.
But Lund and others are still worried that maybe we've hit the limit of our ability to handle distraction, and there's more in-car technology on the way. GM's OnStar may let drivers update their Facebook pages soon. For now, the federal government is taking a wait-and-see approach when it comes to legislating distracted driving. Even Secretary LaHood is toning down the rhetoric, saying he wants to develop partnerships with car companies in his campaign against distracted driving. For NPR News, I'm Tracy Samilton in Ann Arbor.
You're listening to All Things Considered on NPR.
So those movies at Sundance, some of them will be next year's Oscar hopefuls, but now to this year's. The Academy Award nominations were announced this morning, and our movie critic Bob Mandela was here to talk us through them. Hey, Bob.
Hey.
And all these 10 Best Picture nominees, Bob, gave us an inspiration to come up with an idea for a great new movie. We're imagining this pitch from an eager Hollywood screenwriter. You ready? Mm-hmm. Here goes. A Pixar animated film. It's about a one-eyed, gun-toting ballet dancer with a stutter who flees her lesbian parents and gets trapped in a deep chasm in the Ozarks. Now she's one-armed and one-eyed, and she dreams within a dream that she's created a new social networking site for washed-up boxers. What do you think?
The public will eat it up. That's all 10 of the pictures for Best Picture this year.
There you go.
Let me see if I can do them in the pitches order. That would be Toy Story 3, True Grit, Black Swan, The King's Speech, The Kids Are All Right, 127 Hours, Winter's Bone, Inception, Social Network, and The Fighter.
And Bob, what do you make of that list?
Well, it's a pretty predictable bunch of nominations. There aren't any real surprises. My 10 best list had 9 of the 10, although I cheat a little bit.
Yes, you do. You have a very long list.
Yes.
But we always love surprises or controversies in Oscar nominations. None this year?
Well, the one that I'm always used to complaining about is when a director gets nominated for Best Director and his picture doesn't get nominated for Best Picture, which makes no sense to me at all. With the new system of 10 Best Picture nominees, that will never happen again. This time, the director's nominees were for Black Swan, True Grit, Social Network, King's Speech, and The Fighter, perfectly legitimate pictures that would have been nominated in any year. There is some fuss going the other way, that Inception's director, Christopher Nolan, was not nominated. That'll probably get him a consolation prize for original screenplay.
What about in the acting categories, Bob? Any surprises there?
Again, I think it was pretty straightforward. I think everybody thinks that the best actor race comes down to Jesse Eisenberg as a guy who talks fast and invents Facebook, and Colin Firth's King, who can't talk very well. I think those two are the big ones. If I were guessing, I'd say Natalie Portman's ballet dancer will end up winning Best Actress. Christian Bale has a lock on Best Supporting Actor for his drug-addicted brother in The Fighter. And the one category that's harder to predict because the people in it are not very famous is Best Supporting Actress.
And Bob, we don't have time to talk through every category, even though we might like to. But final thoughts on this year's nominees?
Well, I have one thought about process. This is what makes the Oscars more authoritative than other awards. A film doesn't get to 10 or 12 Oscar nominations without getting cited for things like costume design. And only costume designers, actual people who actually do that work, vote on the nominations for that. There are only a few costume designers out there, so you can get nominated with as few as 20 votes. But those votes really mean something, as opposed to when I vote for best costume in a critics group that I'm in, and I'm thinking really, well, that's a pretty dress. It's why the Academy likes the Oscars to come last, after all the critics have given their awards, after the Golden Globes, after all that. It's as if they're saying, well, okay, the kids get to play, and now the grown-ups are going to come in, and we're going to tell you what's actually what.
Okay. Our movie critic, Bob Mandelin, thanks so much.
It's always a pleasure.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You might think about the State of the Union address as an attempt to talk to our national family by the head of household. It tells us where we've been and where we're going. Well, commentator Erin Kluhn says the idea could also work on a smaller scale. Here she is with her State of the Family address.
Hey, what are you doing? Good evening. Husband Phil, kids Maxine, Willie, and dog Spot, cousin Steve, who's allergic to Spot, Madam Grandma, the man who lives with Grandma, distinguished neighbor kids whose parents are letting you immerse your entire hands in my cheese dip. Before I address the issues that confront us, I'd like to salute some heroes here tonight. Brother Joe, stand up. Joe's a programmer who's been out of work for almost a year. Through this hard time, he never gave up. Joe's planning to Photoshop all of us into Super Bowl 45. Apart from the loss of jobs, healthcare has been an issue in this great family of ours. People, why are there never any Band-Aids in the upstairs closet? I know we can and will do better in the future. You know, in the end, hard times only make us stronger. Phil, you were gone half the year traveling for work, and the kids were sick with Giardia. Did I let them sit idly and snack on yogurt? No, we pledged to stay competitive as a family. We practiced more flute, and 4-year-old Maxine played better than anyone at her preschool variety show.
You lie!
One issue that still needs tackling is our shared level of discourse. Children of this family, going forward, anyone who says a rude or disgusting word at the dinner table will be sent away without dessert.
Oh, Mom.
Finally, let us keep in mind that we're bound as a family by a common history and name, except cousin Carla, who inexplicably changed her name when she got married to Ermendorf. The rest of us will move on to work even harder against incivility. I may sometimes fall short, but I know you will all step up and remember, I didn't spend all that money on tenderloin so you could spend the evening bickering, complaining, or going into anaphylactic shock. God bless our family, and God bless the neighbors. Good night.
Erin Kluhn is a producer for the public radio program To the Best of Our Knowledge in Madison, Wisconsin.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.